Welcome to Season 7 of Game Design Unboxed on the No Direction Network. Daniel Reynolds talks to tabletop game designers about the games they've made. Together, they unbox how the game went from inspiration to publication.
Allplay's Kickstarter for River Valley Jewelcraft, Things on Strings, and Some Assembly Required is currently going until May 14th, so make sure to check them out on Kickstarter today. Thank you for joining me, Danielle, for Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 140, Wine Cellar. Today we are joined by Andrew Stiles, game designer and podcast host of Tabletop Submarine. Thank you for being on, well, 140th episode.
Thanks for having me. I've been a listener for a long time, especially during the early parts of game design for me. It really helped a lot into understanding the space better.
Aw, I love that. And when was earlier times for you?
About 3 years ago. 3.5 years ago, I started this design journey.
What got you in?
COVID, like a lot of people, right? So I was a essential worker, and I was struggling. Doing the work every day was much harder than it had been before, and the stress levels were much higher. My wife was working remotely at home, so I was bringing that stress and the risk home to her every night. And I remember her saying one day, she's like, you know you can quit, right? And I was like, no, I can't quit. All my friends aren't working. I am working. We're making money. People are struggling. Like, I can't give that up. And she's like, yeah, you can. We've been stockpiling for a while. If you just need to be away for 6 months and then figure something out, she's like, you're very hireable. We can get another job other places. You don't have to fight this the whole time. But she said one rule was you have to have something to do all day. You can't just sleep in and hang out and lounge around and watch movies. So then I was like, well, we play games all the time. And I've always kind of wanted to do my own thing of creating a game design. And she's like, well, just do that. She's just like, spend 6 months and do that. And so I took it like it was my job and I really attacked it thoroughly. And she said, basically, you don't have to go back to work if you sign a game in the first year. And I was like, that's a challenge accepted. So I was lucky enough to really take it professionally and attack it professionally. And in that way, I was able to put a ton of time in. And just like anything, if you put a lot of time in, you do a lot of research, you can get pretty good at pretty much anything you choose your mind to.
It's funny because one of my co-designers is also an illustrator, and he started illustrating in high school and then ended up at one of the top schools in the United States. And he's like, it's just a skill-based thing. Like, you have to have a spark of talent, but really it's the masters become masters from practice. So that's really interesting. And way to go. Your wife sounds great.
She's amazing. No question.
That's such a great challenge. I wish someone would do that to me. Damn. Well, we're here to talk about Wine Cellar. That was your first game, I believe, signed?
Yep. Very first.
Is that what helped you win this challenge?
Yeah, that was the one. Just like anything, though, if you're a game designer, you know you have like 5, 6, 7 things going at once, right? Like, so it was just a matter of which one emerged fastest. And I would say that one was it.
Talk us through the story. Where'd the inspiration come from?
All right. So in a previous life, I used to be a sommelier. So I used to be a wine expert, basically. And you know what they tell writers, write what you know. So for me, it was like, what could I create based on what my specialty knowledge is? And for me, it was about wine and how much I loved it. And one of the things that's an enigma to even a lot of wine, people who are passionate about wine or wine lovers, is how wine ages. And so I thought, what could I do to showcase how a wine ages? And so that's where the idea and inspiration for the timeline on each card came about. So in the game, every bottle is a bottle of wine, and each wine has a time when it's best consumed. And so how do I depict that? So I created an 8-space timeline, and each space on the timeline had a different number on it, 1 through 8. So if you drink it at the time when it's an 8, it's at its peak. If you drink it at 1, that's when it's at its worst. That kind of gradation was a good starting point. Interesting, it was originally a trick-taking game. And then I originally found through the process of playing and playing and playing and playtesting that the auction mechanic was much more smooth and much more interesting. And that's when the game really took off. I want to say about 4 or 5 months in. And I credit Phil Amlon for showing me that one. We did a playtest and he was like, why are you fighting this trick taking thing? Why don't you just do an auction? And I was like, oh, that's amazing. It's funny how I remember specific playtests with specific breakthroughs with specific people. Do you have that as well?
I do, yeah. And I try to put them in my rule book if they allow for playtesters when the publisher gets around to that. Because I've definitely gotten to the point now that I'm like, I can't list every playtester. Because some playtesters are really just for data. Others make those suggestions that change the game, or they like break the game without trying in a way that made me have to make moves to fix it. So I tend to like put a little star next to those people's names in my journal.
Yeah, I mean, you're doing hundreds of play tests, so it's really impossible to get everybody in there. But especially anybody who play tests my game 3 or 4 times, I definitely feel like I got to make sure they're in there.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I mean, it totally depends on the publisher. Some publishers don't even list playtesters, or they'll be like, we'll put a playtest group, or like, you get 5. And I'm like, ugh, I hate this. This is basically a special thanks now.
Sounds like something we need to start putting in our contracts. We get to put a playtester page in the back.
I already feel needy enough with some of the stuff I ask for. I'm not sure I need to add another thing.
Well, that's the thing, though, with us as game designers, is that especially in the early on, we generally get taken advantage. We don't know where the pushback is. We don't know where the spaces we can ask for things and where we can, you know, make amendments to. I'm still finding to learn that space myself.
It's a hard one. And you definitely start to learn as you go what matters most and not. I feel like for me, putting my name on the box, especially the front, is kind of my like number one. I'll die on that hill now.
Absolutely. No question. I won't even consider if not willing to do that.
Yep. Outside of my day job where they don't do that. So like, you know, I apparently didn't die quite on that hill, but I made some amendments to it. For my mind, it's slightly different because they pay me a salary. But yeah, so you create Wine Cellar, you make a change to now this auction bidding. Where'd it go from there? How'd you get it signed?
So I have to credit my mentor Daryl Andrews for that. I had kind of gotten to the point where I was going to start pitching it to publishers, but I did not have a foot in the industry yet. I did not know anybody anywhere. And through the Tabletop Mentorship Program, which, by the way, I highly recommend, it's now being run by the group with Unpub. But yeah, that was an amazing opportunity. And I remember the day I got paired with him, I didn't know him at that point, but I knew of him. You know, at that point, Sagrada had blown up and the world knew him through that. But I knew also lots of other games that I accidentally had from him. I had Mine Old Minds. I had the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle game, some other stuff like that. So I actually feel like I knew him a little bit more as a designer than just that. We had a lot of great sessions talking back and forth, and I learned a lot of things we were not. But the single best moment was the day after he played my game Wine Cellar with his group. And he came on that call and he said, okay, I've played it. You got something here. Let's talk about who'd be a good fit. And we did a 20-minute session of just which publishers were people I should approach versus ones that I shouldn't with what I had. And I learned so much in those 20 minutes that now when I do mentorship for others, I make sure that I have that moment where we actually make sure to sit down and play the game. And then I'll do a compare and contrast with the publishers for what I know now and whether it's a good fit for their game or not. And I think that single-handedly put me into the category of knowing what I was doing before I approached a publisher, which I cannot strongly recommend enough. If you don't know what a publisher does well or what they're trying to do, or at least what their catalog is, some publishers want certain things and they're not going to be upfront about exactly what they want until you meet with them. If you have a pretty good reason for approaching them and you can express what that reason is, then they'll respect you for spending the time to doing the research on them. And it won't look like it's a shotgun approach where you're just trying to hook onto any publisher possible.
I completely agree. One of the most off-putting things for me back when I used to take pitches, when a designer would share me something that was so wildly inappropriate for both Wacky and Wise Wizard, because it just showed that, yeah, okay, they figured out our name, but like you could do that by just looking at an expo list of who's in the exhibitor hall. And that's not a great first impression. And a lot of times with new designers, especially, you don't get a second impression.
No. And it's just so easy for them to ignore an email from a name they don't recognize, right? So the other thing I say to new designers all the time is boots on the ground. You got to go to those conventions. You got to go to where the publishers are at. They don't necessarily have to be the big ones. You don't have to go to Gen Con.
Yeah, I'd recommend, honestly, the smaller ones. You get real time talking to people versus Gen Con where they're stressed out and they're barely going to remember you.
Absolutely. In fact, the smaller the con, the more time they're going to have to talk with you. So target the ones that they're at. If you feel like your best shot is to pitch to, I don't know, let's just say AllPlay, right? Then go look and see which conference that AllPlay goes to and pick one of the smaller ones. And you don't have to be there the whole time. You could go there for a day. If you want to make sure that you want to save your money as much as you can, drive in, get a one-day badge or whatever you want to do, set up the meeting and talk to them and meet them. And I think that goes a long way, not just with how you want to grow yourself as a designer and become known in some way, but that kind of targeted approach makes you seem professional. if that makes sense.
Oh, for sure. I second everything you've said. I think there's a lot of mistakes you can make as a newer designer that can be forgiven. And I do think you can be forgiven for this one, even though I did say it is off-putting. But if you repeat this, it is gonna make it so the person is going to avoid you. If they can remember your face, which typically I only remember the best and the worst, don't be in the worst category. And so with your game, you ended up with 25th Century. I know it took quite a while because I played this game. I feel like it was years ago before it even went to Kickstarter. So like talk through the journey.
So I think the best part of this was after I pitched it to Chad, he was like, yeah, send me a print and play. And then I didn't hear anything from him for a long, long time. I couldn't even tell you how long it was. And I thought it was kind of over. I thought he was no longer interested, you know, and it's easy to think that without actually knowing anything. And then one day, my wife were sitting around having coffee and I got a ding in my email box. And I don't normally put my notifications on, but for whatever reason, it was that day. And it was Chad saying, essentially, I was playing this with my wife last night and she likes it. And she said, you should sign this. And he said, you know what? I think I will. So I have, here's my intent to sign. I was like, yay, did a little happy dance, bounced around, whatever not. That was the day my wife said, oh, so you actually succeeded. I said, well, I haven't actually signed anything yet. She's like, well, as long as you do actually sign something, what's the next? And I was like, ooh, all right, what's the next best thing I've got to put forward? But I remember Chad was exceptional about this because when I look at what Chad does, Chad is a multi-talented person and he's a single operation in which he does everything, right? He hires out for the things he doesn't do personally. But if you look at his catalog, his spectrum is vast. He does an amazing job in a lot of different directions. And I think one of his strengths is that he really celebrates the art of the game that he does. And when he asked me, he's like, which artist would you think would be a best fit on this? And I, you know, had a couple of different ideas, but then I threw out my shot. I said, well, you know, one of my favorite artists is Vincent Dutrait, but that's probably asking too much. And he was like, I'm working on another game with him. I can ask. And so that's how I got Vincent Dutrait to do my art on my very first ever game. So don't be afraid to ask for the things that you think would be a good fit. They can always tell you no, but you never know when they might say yes.
That is pretty legit. Also, I love that it's like wife power in this episode. It's just like your wife does this and then his wife's like, sign it.
Yeah, that's pretty. I didn't even think about it that way. But yeah, that's pretty cool.
Amazing. Okay, so you do end up with a contract and you get into developing it with Chad. Did any changes happen? Like beyond, of course, adding the beautiful art?
Yeah, some things did tweak. So the game at the time that he signed it was a two-player game, and so we had to make it more of a four-player game. It was only originally 18 cards, but I knew that it could expand upward. It was just a matter of doing it. So once we had that discussion, I did the math and did some things and played around with it and made the four-player game. And then after we had the four-player, I was like, well, you know, I could add 18 more cards and we could make it six. And he's like, yeah, let's do that. So it's funny how that math had to be reconfigured for the six-player game, because I wanted it to spread well, right? So I wanted you to be able to play either the first 18 cards, the next 18 cards, the next 18 cards after that, but then also had to work all together. And then as I was working, I was that, you know, any designer who has a contract thinks, oh, well, what if they want an expansion? Maybe I should work on that. So I actually started working on the next 18 cards would be after that, if you wanted to add an expansion. And then once I mentioned it to him, he's like, well, let's just put that in the box. And I was like, okay, yeah, let's just do that. And so that's how it got to the eight-player version of it. And then the reason it didn't go bigger than that, actually, is because it's hard to fit eight people around a table and then be able to see across it, right? So if we were to add more players at that point, which you could absolutely do, it's not difficult, but the table space to lay out your columns of wine becomes much more hard for anybody else to notice around the table.
I honestly appreciate the fact that that was a consideration, because I also do that sometimes where I'm like, okay, yeah, technically we could make it this player count. It doesn't make it a better game. It actually makes it a worse game because of the experience due to not being able to see or hear or, yeah, have enough seats or just a physical table that even fits the amount of content that needs to go on it.
Right. And I'm not saying you couldn't. Like, for instance, if you really wanted to, you could buy two copies of the game, put a black dot on every card on one copy, and then that could be the half mount, right? So it could be a 1.5 instead of a 1 or a 3.5 instead of a 3 or whatever it is. And you could play two full copies at the same time. You could absolutely do that. But yeah, you'd need to have like 2 6-foot or 8-foot tables, and it would just be pure chaos. So I've never done that. One day I'd like to try, but I don't think so.
Yeah, that's totally fair. So beyond like the player count, did any of the rules change through development?
In the original game also, the cards themselves had little scoring metrics, which were the client cards, right? So the way I originally designed it, I thought it was so clever at the time, was whatever card you ended up with last was the client that you ended up with. And so you were kind of whittling down your client as you went through the game. So you might have like been like, well, I want to save the 26 because the 26 has the client that lines up with the wines that I've collected so far. But it was that one extra half step of processing as you go that started to slow the game down a lot. It was also the kind of thing that people were checking the very bottom of their cards frequently in a way that was inorganic. It didn't feel right. And then Chad was like, well, this game is nothing but cards. Let's just make some more cards. And I was like, oh, but everything I was taught was to keep my component as low as possible and to do as much with those components, you know, as much as possible. He's like, yeah, that's the case. But at some point, there's also a diminishing return, right? Like, where at some point, putting extra 18 cards in the game doesn't hurt anything and costs so minimal that it's worth doing. And once that conversation took place, now I was able to change all the math on the client cards and have a better spread, right? For that, it was not quite as restrictive based on what card it was paired with. Separating those out meant I could be much more flexible in the whole thing. And that's why the deck now has like 50 client cards in it. Like it's got a big spread of different possibilities.
No, I think that's a really good point. You said you got trained essentially to use your components to the best of the ability and like add things to try to reduce component count to make it cheaper. So that's like a really good point. And it is something that I try to tell people to consider while they're making a game, to think of it as a product with those things in mind. But a lot of us don't have that background. Like, yeah, I worked in manufacturing and I've worked in printing. So I do, but most people don't. But I think if you get to a point where it's not helping the design. So for instance, you'll notice that mass market party games a lot of times have like 200 cards. That's typically pretty average. But they could make it essentially 400 if they made them double-sided, but they don't. Have you ever wondered why?
I do wonder on certain games why, right? For instance, I know that there are games that do that and they put the box where the cards stand upright in the box and you draw from the box. If you're drawing from the table, then you really want to have the backside not be visible in order to make it not cheating because they're different on different sides, but it feels like cheating when you can see the card ahead of time, right?
So it's actually not for cheating reasons. It's because of branding and marketing. They want it to show the name in the pictures, in the videos of players playing. So that way people can recognize, because if you've seen Cards Against Humanity and how many various clones of that and apples to apples there are, it's a lot of text on cards. Like you can't tell what game that came from, which is why you need the branding of the backs. But also, yes, there is that additional confusion element of, did I already draw this card? Do I flip this card over to this side? Even though you would have more content, which in my mind is a value add because it's a content-driven party game, so you'd want more content for more replayability, the not being able to market it appropriately actually outweighs it. And so that's why they tend to do it. And a lot of people are like, whoa, wait, oh, that does make sense, but it's also kind of weird because they're both very valid reasons. Having more content is important for replayability, but if people can't tell what game is getting played when you're taking pictures, which is like word of mouth, digitally, almost like FOMO marketing, the best way to try to sell additional copies, it's like, okay, selling additional copies means more than replayability because once you buy it, and if you don't even play it more than the once or twice, it's okay because they've already bought it.
It's definitely true. And we live in a Instagram and TikTok world, so those things drive things.
We do. Yep. So good thing your game is very pretty.
Yeah, no, I'm very blessed that way, no question.
Yeah, so how is the game being received now that it's officially out?
I have been blown away by people's kindness in making sure that they share with me their game being played in various locations. I think that is really the best part of being a game designer is seeing your creation out in the world. And not every artist gets that kind of feedback. I mean, you know, you buy somebody's painting and they get the purchase and you transfer the money. But then do you ever get a chance to see that on the wall? Or, you know, somebody reads your book. Yeah, they might leave a review, but you don't actually see them in a quiet corner with a smile on their face and a cup of tea in their hand, right? Like you don't actually get to see the moments of them enjoying it. And that's one of the cool things about, I think, game design is that games are actively being played and you can sometimes watch that happen. And that's really cool.
I really enjoy watching just like a random TikTok video. And then I happen to see like her story in the background or caution signs, just like living in their home. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm like decorating their house essentially. I'm like, this is great. A little piece of me is there.
That is so cool. I totally agree. And then it was recently announced at Gamma, which I'm very, very happy about. It is a finalist for the Origins Award for Gateway Game of the Year, which has been amazing.
That is so good. And I'm sure you're going to be at Origins to see if you win.
Absolutely. But that said, if you look at the list of people who are on that list, I don't give Wine Cellar a top three chance at it. But just like everything else, I am so, so enthralled to be nominated. And the fact that it's going to be on that big table with the Origins Awards, and you can walk around the convention hall and you can kind of see it on the table next to all these other amazing games. It's just, that's truly spectacular.
Oh yeah, it's excellent marketing. Being nominated for anything, good press. How long in total do you think it took from that initial inspiration to the game coming out?
I'd say probably 3 years. I mean, I started doing it 3.5 years ago and the game came out halfway through last year. So yeah, I'd say about 3 years, which I know everybody warned me was going to be a long, long time. And it kind of fit the timeline there. But man, 3 years is so much longer than you think it is.
You're like, this is painful. I promise you, I have a game signed. And you know that a game can still come back to you because all the shenanigans that's happened over the past few years.
And I've been told that you're not a real game designer until something does get returned to you at some point. So yeah, I feel that pain.
You're still waiting for that bingo card to get checked? Or did you have that happen?
Oh, no. It already happened. It already happened.
Oh, welcome to the club. It's not a great club. And what do you feel like people are finding special about this design that's kind of getting it to that point of nominated?
I think it's the 8-person player count. I think too many people have to compromise when enough people show up to game night to the kind of game they want to play. For me and my wife, we like to play 2-player games that we can settle into for a period of time, like really sit down and play. So we play Ark Nova a lot. We play Wingspan a lot. We play games that, like, we played a lot of Covenant lately, games that you really feel like you can fall into, right? But I think a lot of people have game nights where there's 4 or 5 people come into play and they pick your game based on the player count. But as soon as that 6th, 7th, or even that 8th person shows up, it changes the entire dynamic to either we split up into 2 groups or we end up playing party games. And I feel like party games are excellent, but they're not excellent when that's not your intention or it's not what you want to play that night. And so this kind of bridges a little bit of a gap there. And because it's such an easy game to play relatively quickly, I think people also can either play it before game night starts with whoever happens to show up and then you split up in the group and do your thing, whatever, not. Or you can make it the tent pole and just play multiple rounds. And I think the reason it's being celebrated as the gateway game is because the way I designed it to be a game that non-gamers play. I really wanted this to be a love letter to the wine industry and the people that I know who love wine, who've never played a game that wasn't Uno, Monopoly, or maybe Spades. There are plenty of people in this world who don't understand that games can be so much more than what they already know from their childhood. And so this was just one way of me saying, hey, if you love wine, right, here's a card game that is nothing but cards that showcases all the wines that you love. And I made sure to meticulously put in also that every wine bottle in the game has tasting notes that are semi-legit. Like, I didn't pick a specific bottle and took their tasting notes. I took several bottles and took a spread of tasting notes from all of them. So if you were to find a bottle in the wild and you were to compare it to the card, probably one of those tasting notes would match up to whatever you find in that bottle.
That's so cool. I'm feeling like a combo, play this game, play charcuterie, wine and charcuterie night in my future.
I think that's great. I'm a big fan of Whitney, so I think that would be a wonderful pairing. I love that.
Yeah. I love a themed experience with games. I've definitely probably have enough food and drink games in this apartment to make that happen. But they do tend to fall into the lower player count. So I like that. I think charcuterie goes to 6 and yours goes to 8. So.
Well, also I tell people who are playing the game, whoever wins the game gets to pick the next bottle. That's how the prizing works.
Ooh. Good thing I have a lot of wine in my fridge/cupboard. I don't drink alone and people keep giving me wine. So, I mean, it's not a bad problem to have.
Absolutely not.
Nope. So then what was your favorite and your least favorite experience of this design journey?
That's a really good question. I would say my most favorite was seeing people in the wild play the game and then not knowing it was me that designed it for the first time. And it happened at Tantrum Con after it was announced that it was on Kickstarter. And then we had a couple of pre-production copies there and Chad put them on the play to win table at Tantrum Con. And so I could walk around the room and I could try to find out where the two copies were and then watch people play. And they didn't know that I designed it. That was probably the most fun thing that I was able to do on my very first game design. I'd say the least favorite is definitely the time it took to get there. Like just the excruciating amount of, I promise I'm a game designer. There's a game coming. But then you don't actually know if it is coming because there's so many things that can gum up the works or stop it from being happening or just delay it another year or delay it longer than that, that it doesn't feel real until the day I held the box in my hands. That's when it felt real.
Sounds like when you're a parent, just like, oh, my baby's in front of me. And oh my God, I'm now a human that has a human. And what was your biggest takeaway from the experience of working on this game?
For me, it was, I think you get what out of it you put into it, right? Like, I feel like I put a ton of love into this thing and I put a lot of effort into this thing. And because of that, I think it shows. And I think that's what's doing so well is the fact that I spent the time to do it right as much as I possibly could. I wanted my first game to be truly right. And with that, the effort shows. And I'm not saying that for those people out there who are not putting in the effort. I'm not saying that at all. I think every designer who's doing this is doing it as a complete passion project, and they squeeze the time they can where they can. Don't be afraid to let it take a little longer and put a little more time in, because I think it really does end up making it better. And who doesn't want their first game design not to be a success, right? Like, you don't want to just put something out there with your name on it and have it be on a shelf, and then people go, meh. Like, that's not the response you want. So put as much time as you can into whatever you're working on.
To piggyback that, I was on a panel with Elizabeth Hargrave and Connie Vogelman talking about strategy games. And all of us agreed that, especially with a strategy game, when you're pitching it, don't expect the publisher to do additional development. When you're pitching, make sure you feel comfortable that if they were to just sign it and print it as it is right now, you would not feel embarrassed with your name being on the box. That's a good metric for any time you're thinking, should I pitch this game? If you're still in a very rough state where you're changing a lot, save it, wait, do more work, solidify more things, have more playtesters come away saying, no, it's great, it's perfect, I can't think of what to change. So often a publisher will be like, great, it's done, without consulting the designer, or they'll make you do further development. So you're developing either direction. It's just, are you doing it on the front end or the back end?
Yeah, and I'll piggyback off that in a little bit ways. One of the things that when you're pitching to a publisher, they're going to ask a lot of questions. And the questions aren't necessarily meant to be mean, but they are to illustrate how much work you did, right? Like, so if a publisher asks you, well, why didn't you choose to do this? I have an answer for that because I playtested that. And if you have those answers, it gives them the confidence that if they feel like, you know, after they play it a couple of times, they want to make a tweak, they can come back to you and you can either give them a reason why it doesn't work, or two, you already have a head start in that direction that you can figure out the differences and ways to make it better. I think it's also important, especially for your first game, volunteer that development time to your publisher. One, because it's a value add, right? It's not them paying somebody else to develop a game that they got from you. But also, why wouldn't you want to have your hands in that development process and at least use all that experience that you got and all that playtesting to then push it forward in the way that they need it to? Because I think every publisher has things that their audience either wants or likes or appreciates. There's got to be a through line through their catalog, right? And so sometimes they develop something to fit better their audience. It's not that they're trying to change your game or rearrange it or make it not work. They want it to also work for their people. And so if you have your hands in the process, yeah, you're better off.
I agree. I do think that you should still have an other developer, whether that is the publisher or someone that they're hiring as a freelancer, because two brains are always better than one. and having someone to talk back and forth with. But I don't love when a publisher just kind of takes the game and doesn't consult the designer, because so often they will try to bring the game down a pathway that the designer already tried and it failed for whatever reason. And that just, like, time and money, just hopping on a call, even if the designer is not, like, super actively involved in the development, but just can go through, hey, we're thinking about this, 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 this. And designer goes, no, don't do that. Yeah, maybe that. Oh, that seems cool. What about this? That, I think, is one of my ideal choices. Anytime I have a game signed, is like, I want to be involved. I have too many projects at this point. Like, I don't want to do my own development on every game, but being able to have those calls and check-ins are great.
I agree. And the two heads is better one is definitely true, which is why I have so many co-designs now that will be coming out soon.
Well, cool. Tell me more about those, or the ones you're allowed to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first one coming out this year is Digging for Dinos by 3WS. That is a tactical set collection, tile-based game where you are paleontologists digging around at a dig site and you're digging up dinosaur bones and then putting together the skeletons. That was originally designed as a kids game that wouldn't suck for adults to play. And I think I've accomplished that. So I'm really kind of excited about that one. That one is coming to retail very soon, probably end of the month or next month. We're just waiting on shipping times as far as that coming over from China. Also, they're working on a board game arena implementation. So that'll be my first board game arena game, which is really kind of cool. I'm excited about that. And then after that, at the end of this month, there's Kickstarter for Garden Club, which is a co-design with Kristen Mott. That is a not quite cozy, but cozy-ish gardening game where you are semi-cooperatively building a garden together, but you're also trying to thwart your opponent by having the flowers and the vegetables that you want in the garden and not the ones that they want. So there's some secret objectives going on. There's some tactical movement with the tools that mess up the board and change things as far as that goes. And then there's also like a little area control thing where you want to harvest the fruits and vegetables that are most prevalent in the garden, and you want to make sure your opponent does not. That's Garden Club, if that sounds interesting to you. And that was a fun game because Chris Couch Games, who's doing the development on the game, signed it. After doing some development and making it more of a big game, he's like, you know, but I really like the original game too. So now there's also Petal, which is a travel version of the game that's just the original card game that was originally there. So we got two games in one contract, which I thought was pretty fun. But that's coming to Kickstarter, and that's amazing. And then it's only been announced briefly, but I have a game with Maestro Media. And so it's an IP game, and I'm really excited about that. And it's in the Avatar Pandora world. It's called Avatar Fight for Pandora. It is a two-player tactical and lane battler with asymmetrical player powers. Each deck plays completely different than the other, and there are going to be four decks in the game. And I'm excited about that one, too.
That is super cool. Is that an IP that you really liked?
It is an IP that I really liked. The game originally wasn't designed for that, but when Maestro Media signed it, they said this is a lane battle that can work for a lot of different IPs. And then so it's just a matter of picking the right one and then making the development process fit that one specifically. And I was really excited when they said, do you think you could make this work for Avatar? I was like, oh, wow, could I do that? Yes, absolutely. And having four factions on that one, I developed two. And then Bobby West, the developer, developed the other two to go along with it. So it was really kind of cool to see now the mishmashing of the four sides.
Interesting. IP work is always so fascinating, trying to make sure that it fits and that it's not just a label slap. Because I think our bar for IP games have gotten a lot higher because they're actually good now.
Yeah, I 100% agree. But also, I think the reason they're difficult is the approval process.
Oh, yes.
The fact that this is not in box now is a testament to the fact that Disney and James Cameron's team are being really meticulous as they go through this game to make sure that everything matches the world and matches the art and then matches the graphic design, all the different things that they want to make sure the game looks right.
Yeah. Oh, have you ever seen, oh my God, what is the font that they use for the Avatar logo? But basically they did like a SNL skit about it, how this guy's just like freaking out that it's a general font that they picked for the movie, and it like keeps them up at night. It's so funny.
Yeah, I've not seen that skit, and I can't tell you what the font is, but that is funny.
That's okay. I will probably just Google it at some point, but everyone should definitely look it up. It's really entertaining. All right, for my last question before we close out the show, I want to know, if you could have designed a game that wasn't yours, what would it be?
This is such a great question, and I think different days would have different answers, but for me, the one game I really wish I'd designed is Raw. It's just a truly classic game that does all the things that I adore. One, I love a good auction. But also, two, I love where every player has an equal opportunity at the beginning of the game, but then you're in charge of your own destiny and how the game unfolds as far as what values you then have access to going forward. The fact that you bid with your token and then take another token in response, and then that is your new bidding value for the next round, that makes that game masterclass.
It is really good. Do you like the newer implementation or the older one?
I don't know if I've played the newer one. I know I've played the newer version, right? Like I've played the gorgeous version by 25th Century and Eon Tool Art and stuff like that. I don't know if I know the difference between the new version and the old version, though.
The main difference that I noticed is you can track the game better in the older version because you're using like a leftover tile to basically show the game state, which I really liked. And I was a little sad they removed, even though the newer one is definitely a lot nicer. That's kind of my hot take. And I did look it up. So the avatar title font is Papyrus, and it is really funny. You should definitely look up that skit on SNL.
That is so funny. Yeah, Papyrus is a terrible font. So the fact that they made it look good is actually kind of amazing.
There we go. And shade thrown to a font. That's how we do it here at Game Design Unboxed.
Well, I'm originally an art director in advertising. It's where my degree came from. And so, yeah, there are definitely fonts to keep me up at night.
Perfect. So you'll relate to this one. Well, do you have anything else that we haven't talked about for Wine Cellar that you'd like to mention before we close out this episode?
No, I'm just thankful for everybody who got a chance to play it. And for people who enjoy it, that's even better. I guess one thing I'd like to see more of in the world is that when you appreciate a game and you play it a lot, send a little note to the designer or send a little note to the publisher, letting them know how much joy they've brought to your life.
Oh, I very much enjoy when someone tags me and them playing it on like their Instagram story or in their posts. I'm just like, oh my God, yay, Caution Signs or whatever game they're playing. Well, thank you so much to everyone who's been listening to this episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 140, Wine Cellar. And Andrew, thanks for being on the show. I know you've been listening, and I know I was on your show years ago for your podcast. Anyone trying to find you, or even your podcast, where can you be found?
I have a Blue Sky account that I'm trying to be better on, but realistically, I'm old, so I'm on Facebook. And as much as I don't love Facebook, it's an easy access portal for tearing about my game. And I like to post there. So it's a nice and easy place.
Cool. And I'm sure you have a BGG account too.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Cool. And then I'm your host. I'm Danielle Reynolds. If you're trying to find me on my personal social media, I got the Instagram and Blue Sky under the name Token Gamer, spelled G-A-Y-M-E-R. And then of course I have these fun short form videos and tips for Game Design Unboxed under that name for TikTok and Instagram, as well as, yeah, BGG and, you know, my personal website, dmarkcreativegroup.com. So lots of places to look to find both of us, and definitely enjoy this game because I had a lot of fun playing it years ago and I need to pick up a copy. I actually don't have one.
Thank you for joining Danielle for another episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication. If you'd like to hear more great gaming podcasts, check out nodirectionpodcasts.com. And if you're looking for a great board game, bag, playmat, or table, check out All Play at letsallplay.com. Join us next time.